From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I wanted to do every destructive thing that I could think of at that time to hurt anyone that had hurt us through the years.
It's like just when you see a man protecting his own life. They weren't the queens that people call them. They were men fighting for their lives. And I'd fight alongside them any day, no matter how old I was.
A lot of heads were bashed. But it didn't hurt their true feelings. They all came back for more.
Remembering Stonewall, today we look back 30 years to the movement that began the gay rights movement. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. KFOR, the NATO-led security force in Kosovo, may have to play a double role as police and peacekeeper for longer than planned due to delays in setting up a civilian United Nations-run police force. This in the Financial Times today. A week ago, United Nations officials said 150 UN civilian police were to arrive within days from Bosnia. But as revenge killings and looting showed no sign of abating, it emerged that the first contingent of some 40 civilian police had yet to arrive, and UN officials have acknowledged that there's still no timetable for deployment of the full force of 3,000 police envisaged. It may now be 3 to 6 months before KFOR hands over its civilian policing role. Diplomats insist relations between KFOR and the UN civilian administration is good, but UN officials are concerned that the NATO-led force has not been able to provide sufficient security and stop the exodus of the Serb minority. Meanwhile, the first private estimate of what the war over Kosovo cost you is in. The Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments says the air campaign may have cost as much as $4 billion. That includes 90 air-launched cruise missiles that cost $2 million each. It also includes 450 Tomahawk cruise missiles that are a relative bargain at $1 million apiece. It's a little difficult to figure the total cost since the Pentagon has not given details on how many munitions other than cruise missiles were used. It also hasn't put a price tag on the deployment of 725 aircraft and more than 10,000 army troops and reservists. This news from Beijing. China marked World Anti-Narcotics Day last week by executing 58 drug traffickers, this in the Chinese newspapers today. Authorities in the southern boomtown city of Guangzhou executed 28 people for trafficking and manufacturing drugs on Friday, according to the Yangcheng Evening News, an edition seen today. It said the 28 were put to death after more than 10,000 people attended their public sentencing in six different places around the city. Drug use in China virtually wiped out after the Communist Party took power in 1949, has made a comeback with two decades of market reform and relaxed social controls. Pre-positioned soldiers, not protesters, fired on a huge demonstration in Mexico City just 10 days before the opening of the 1968 Olympics. This, according to papers belonging to a former defense secretary, now published as book excerpts. Government critics have argued for decades that it was Mexican soldiers responsible for the Tlatelolco massacre when some 300 people were shot to death during an anti-government demonstration in Mexico City. The government maintained that only 29 people died and it accused communist agitators of shooting. Many organizers of the protests were imprisoned for several years after. Officials have repeatedly denied claims by witnesses that government snipers fired on the crowd from apartment towers surrounding the Plaza of Three Cultures in the Tlatelolco neighborhood. But the magazine Proceso yesterday published excerpts from a soon-to-be-published book, War Report, which bolster the witnesses' claim. This news about Rwanda. In a long-awaited humanitarian gesture, the Congolese government has freed the first of 540 civilians, including foreign citizens locked up in camps during the civil war. The 120 Congolese, Tutsis, and Rwandans released yesterday appeared in good condition, according to the International Committee of the Red Cross, which chartered a plane to fly them from the southern Congolese city of Lubumbashi to the Rwandan capital of Kigali. Most Congolese Tutsis and Rwandan Tutsis in Congo left the capital of Kinshasa before the outbreak of hostilities August 2, 1998. The British and Irish prime ministers hope that 3 days of make-or-break negotiations starting today will rescue the Northern Ireland peace process and enable the new government of Catholics and Protestants to begin work. British Prime Minister Tony Blair and his Irish counterpart Bertie Ahern returned today to Belfast to begin the intensive round of talks aimed at saving last year's peace accord. Blair has set a Wednesday deadline for the agreement to get back on track or fail. In Ferndale, Washington, a tanker unloading oil at the Tosco refinery became untethered, spilling as much as 1,050 gallons of crude oil into the North Puget Sound. The stern of the Arco Texas became unmoored yesterday afternoon, according to the U.S. Coast Guard. As the ship drifted away from the dock, the metal arm that carries oil from the tanker to the refinery was bent and broken, and oil spilled into the water.
Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on. Freedom's name is mine.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This weekend, gays and straights alike celebrated Stonewall 30, the 30th anniversary of the historic riots which helped spark the modern-day gay rights movement. On the night of June 27, 1969, the Stonewall Inn, a drag bar in Greenwich Village, New York, was raided by the Vice Squad. At the time, gay bars were routinely shut down by police, and the Stonewall itself had been raided earlier that week. Typically, patrons would quietly submit to the police, afraid that their identities might be revealed. But that June night at the Stonewall Inn, patrons of the bar, with the drag queens in the lead, decided to fight back. To many, the 3 days of rioting that ensued marked the birth of gay activism in the United States, and it's interesting to note that it was police brutality that sparked the movement. Well, 10 years ago, on the 20th anniversary of Stonewall, producer David Isay made a documentary for Pacifica Radio called Remembering Stonewall. Today, we bring you the documentary once again.
I'm Gene Harwood, and my age is 80.
I'm Bruce Merrill.
I don't know if it's really true, but now people do refer to us as the two oldest gay men in America. We do, I think, have maybe a record relationship of almost 60 years together. Being gay before Stonewall was a very difficult proposition because we felt that in order to survive, we had to try to look and act as rugged and manly as possible to get by in the society that was really very much against us.
My name is Randy Wicker. I was the first openly gay person to appear on radio in 1962 and on television in 1964 as a self-identified homosexual. In the year before Stonewall, people felt a need to hide because of the precarious legal position they were in. They would lose their jobs. There was a great hostility, socially speaking, in the sense of people found out you were gay, they assumed you were a communist or a child molester or any of another dozen stereotypes that were rampant in the public media at the time.
I'm Jerry Fair, and I'm 80 years old. I started a gay lifestyle in 1948 when I was around 39 or 40. At that time, if there was even a suspicion that you were a lesbian, you were fired from your job, and you were in such a position of disgrace that you slunk out without saying goodbye even to the people that liked you and you liked. Never even bothered to clean your desk. You just disappeared. You just disappeared. You went quietly because you were afraid that the recriminations that would come if you even stood there and protested would be worse than just leaving.
My name is Sylvia Rivera. My name before that was Ray Rivera until I started dressing in drag in 1961. The era before Stonewall was a hard era. There was always the gay bashings on the drag queens by heterosexual men, women, and the police. We learned to live with it because it was part of the lifestyle at that time, I guess. But none of us were very happy about it.
My name is Seymour Pine,
In 1968, I was assigned as deputy inspector in charge of public morals in the 1st Division in the police department, which covered the Greenwich Village area. It was the duty of public morals to enforce all laws concerning vice and gambling, including prostitution, narcotics, and laws and regulations concerning homosexuality. The part of the penal code which applied to drag queens was section 240.35, section 4. Being masked or in any manner disguised by unusual or unnatural attire or facial alteration, loiters, remains, or congregates in a public place with other
persons. At that time, we lived
so
at the Arista Hotel.
Except that such
conduct, we sit around, just try to figure out when this harassment would come to an end. And we would always dream that one day it would come to an end. And we prayed and we looked for it. We wanted to be human beings.
My name is Red Mahoney. I've been hanging out, drinking, partying, and working in the gay bars for the last 30 years. In the era before Stonewall, all of the bars, 90% of the bars, were mafia-controlled. There wasn't that many gay bars. You'd have maybe one, two uptown in the Upper East Side. They would get closed down, and there'd be one or two in the West Side. They'd get closed down, and Midtown, there'd be one, two, three maybe open. As they would get closed down, they'd move around, and they were dumps.
I'm Joan Nessel, co-founder of what is now the largest collection of lesbian culture in the world. The police raided lesbian bars regularly, and they did it, they both did it in the most obvious way, which was hauling women away in paddy wagons, but there was regular weekend harassment, which would consist of the police coming in regularly to get their payoffs. And in the Sea Colony, we had a back room with a red light, and when that red light went on, it meant the police would be arriving in around 10 minutes. And so we all had to sit down at our tables, and we would be sitting there almost like school children. And the cops would come in. Now, depending on who was on, which cop was on, if it was some that really resented the butch women, who were with many times very beautiful women, we knew we were in for it, because what would happen is they would start harassing one of these women and saying, "Hi, you think you're a man? Come outside, we'll show you." And the woman would be dragged away. They'd throw up against a wall, and they'd say, "So you think you're a man? Let's see what you got in your pants." And they would put their hand down her pants.
The Stonewall, oh, that was a good bar. That was. Just to get into the Stonewall, you'd walk up and you'd knock on the front door. You'd knock and the little door would open and, "Hey, what do you want?" "A Mary sent me." "Good, come on in, girls." You know, the Stonewall, like all gay bars at that time, were painted black. Charcoal black. And what was the funny part? The place would be so dimly lit, but as soon as the cops were going to come in to collect their percentage or whatever they were coming in for, from it being a nice, dimly lit dump, the place was lit up like Luna Park.
You felt, well, two guys, and that's very often all we sent in would be two men, could handle 200 people. I mean, you tell them to leave, and they leave, and you say, "Show me your identification," and they all take out their identification and file out, and that's it, and you say, "Okay, you're not a man, you're a woman, or you're vice versa, and you wait over there." I mean, this is a kind of power that you have, and you never gave it a second thought.
The drag queen took a lot of oppression, and we had to... We were at a point where I guess nothing would have stopped us. I guess, as they say, or as Shakespeare says, we were ladies in waiting, just waiting for the thing to happen. And when it did happen, we were there.
On Friday evening, June 27, 1969, at about 11:45, 8 officers from New York City's Public Morals Squad loaded into 4 unmarked police cars and headed to the Stonewall Inn here at 7th Avenue and Christopher Street. The local precinct had just received a new commanding officer, who kicked off his tenure by initiating a series of raids on gay bars. The Stonewall was an inviting target. Operated by the Gambino crime family without a liquor license, the dance bar drew a crowd of drag queens, hustlers, and minors. A number of the bar's patrons had spent the early part of the day outside the Frank Campbell funeral home, where Judy Garland's funeral was held. She had died the Sunday before. It was almost precisely at midnight that the Moral Squad pulled up to the Stonewall Inn, led by Deputy Inspector Seymour Pine.
There was never any reason to feel that anything of any unusual situation would occur that night.
You could actually feel it in the air. You really could. I guess Judy Garland's death just really helped us really hit the fan.
For some reason, things were different this night. As we were bringing the prisoners out, they were resisting.
People started gathering in front of the Sheridan Square Park right across the street from Stonewall. People were upset. No, we're not going to go. And people started screaming and hollering.
One drag queen, as we put her in the car, opened the door on the other side and jumped out, at which time we had to chase that person. And he was caught, put back into the car. He made another attempt to get out the same door, the other door. And at that point, we had to handcuff the person. From this point on, things really began to get crazy.
My name is Robert Rivera, and my nickname is Birdie, and I've been cross-dressing all of my life. I remember the night of the riots. The police were escorting the queens out of the bar and into the paddy wagon. And there was this one particularly outrageously beautiful queen with stacks and stacks of Elizabeth Taylor style hair. And she was asking them not to push her. And they continued to push her, and she turned around and she mashed the cop with her high heel. She knocked him down, and then she proceeded to frisk him for the keys to the handcuffs that were on him. She got them, and she undid herself and passed them to another queen that was behind her.
Well, that's when all hell broke loose at that point. And then we had to get back into the Stonewall.
My name is Howard Smith. On the night of the Stonewall riots, I was a reporter for the Village Voice, locked inside with the police, covering it for my column. It really did appear that crowd, because we could look through little peepholes in the plywood windows, we could look out. And we could see that the crowd, well, my guess was within 5-10 minutes, it was probably several thousand people. Now, 2,000, easy. And they were yelling, kill the cops, police brutality, let's get them, we're not going to take this anymore, let's
we
get them.
We noticed a group of persons attempting to uproot one of the parking meters, in which they did succeed, and they then used that parking meter to as a battering ram to break down the door, and they did in fact open the door. They crashed it in, and at that point was when they began throwing Molotov cocktails into the place. It was a situation that we didn't know how we were going to be able to control.
I remember someone throwing a Molotov cocktail. I don't know who the person was, but I mean, I saw that, and I just said to myself in Spanish, I said, oh my God, the revolution is finally here. And I just like started screaming, freedom. We're free at last, you know, and it felt really good.
There were a couple of cops stationed on either side of the door with their pistols, like in a combat stance, aimed in the door area. A couple others were stationed in other places, behind like a pole, another one behind the bar, all of them with their guns ready. I don't think up to that point I had ever seen cops that scared.
Remember, these were pros, but everybody was frightened. There's no question about that. I know I was frightened.
and I'd been in combat situations, and there was never any time that I felt more scared than I felt that night. And I mean, there was just, you know, there was no place to run.
Once the tactical police force showed up, I think that really incited us a little bit more.
My name is Martin Boyce, and in 1969, I was a drag queen known as Miss Martin. I remember on that night, when we saw the riot police, all of us drag queens, we linked arms, like the Rockettes, and sang the song we used to sing. We are the village girls, we wear our hair in curls, we wear our dungarees above our Nelly knees. And the police went crazy hearing that, and they just immediately rushed us. We gave one kick and fled.
You're listening to Remembering Stonewall, a documentary produced by David Isay. We'll be back here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! With it in a minute.
Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on. Freedom's name is mighty sweet. Soon someday we're gonna meet. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on. The only chain that a man can stand is the chain of a hand in hand. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on. Hold on. Hold on. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on. The only thing that we did wrong, we stayed in the wilderness a day too long. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, The Exception to the Rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with the documentary produced by David Isay, Remembering Stonewall, on the night of June 27th, 1969, 30 years ago, the Stonewall Inn, a drag bar in Greenwich Village, New York, was raided by the Vice Squad. At the time, gay bars were routinely shut down by police, and the Stonewall itself had been raided earlier in the week.
My name is Rudy. And the night of the Stonewall, I was 18. And to tell you the truth, that night I was doing more running than fighting. I remember looking back from 10th Street. And there on Waverly Street, there was a police, I believe, on his cop, and is on his stomach in his tactical uniform and his helmet and everything else, with a drag queen straddling him. She was beating the hell out of him with her shoe. Whether it was a high heel or not, I don't know. But she was beating the hell out of him. It was hysterical. Yeah.
My name is Mama Jean. I'm a lesbian. I remember on that night, I was in a gay bar, a woman's bar, called Cookies. We were coming out of the gay bar, going toward 8th Street. And that's when we saw everything happen. Blasting away, people getting beat up. Police coming from every direction. Hitting women as well as men with their nightsticks. Gay men running down the street with blood all over their face. We decided right then and there whether we scared or not. We didn't think about it. We just jumped in.
Here, this queen is going completely bananas, you know, jumping and hitting the windshield. And next thing you know, the taxi cab was being turned over, or the cars were being turned over, things. Windows were shattering all over the place. Fires were burning around the place. It was beautiful. It really was. It was really beautiful.
I remember one cop coming at me, hitting me with the nightstick in the back of my legs. I broke loose, and I went after him. I grabbed his nightstick. My girlfriend went behind him. She was a strong seven again. I wanted him to feel the same pain I felt. And I kept on saying to him, "How do you like the pain? Do you like it? Do you like it?" And I kept on hitting him and hitting him. I was angry. I wanted to kill him. At that particular minute, I wanted to kill him.
I wanted to do every destructive thing that I could think of at that time to hurt anyone that had hurt us through the years.
It's like just when you see a man protecting his own life. They weren't the queens that people call them. They were men fighting for their lives. And I'd fight alongside them any day, no matter how old I was.
A lot of heads were bashed that night. A lot of people were hurt. But it didn't hurt their true feelings. They all came back for more and more. Nothing. That's when you could tell that nothing could stop us at that time or at any time in the future.
I'll be loving you every time I love again.
The riots were well covered in the media. The New York Daily News featured it on the front page. There were reports on all of the local television and radio stations. By the next day, graffiti calling for gay power had started to show up all over the West Village. The next night, thousands of men and women came back to the Stonewall to see what would happen next. While a couple of trash cans were set on fire and some stones were thrown, the 400 riot police milling around outside the bar ensured that the previous evening's violence would not be repeated. But on this night, gay couples could be spotted walking hand in hand and kissing in the streets. Just by being at the Stonewall, surrounded by reporters, photographers, and onlookers, thousands of men and women were proclaiming that they were gay. The crowds grew and came back the next night and for one more night the following week. What happened at the Stonewall on those nights helped to usher in a new era for gay men and lesbians.
When Stonewall happened, Bruce and I were still in the closet where we had been for nearly 40 years, but we realized that this was a tremendous thing that had happened at Stonewall, and it gave us a feeling that we were not going to be remaining closeted for very much longer. And soon thereafter, we did come out of the closet.
My name is Ginny Apuzzo. In 1969, I was in the convent, and when Stonewall hit the press, it hit me with a bolt of lightning. It was as if I had an incredible release of my own outrage at having to sequester so much of my life. I made my way down. I seem to recall in subsequent nights being down on the, you know, kind of just in the periphery looking, observer, clearly an observer, clearly longing to have that courage to come out. And was a matter, as I recall, it was only a matter of weeks before I left the convent and started a new life.
I'm Henry Baird. In 1969, I was in the U.S. Army, a Specialist 3 stationed at Long Binh Post near Saigon in Vietnam. I remember I was having lunch in the Army mess, reading the Armed Forces news summary of the day. And there was a short paragraph describing a riot led by homosexuals in Greenwich Village against the police. And my heart was filled with joy. I thought about what I had read frequently, but I had no one to discuss it with, and secretly within myself I decided that when I came back stateside, if I should survive to come back stateside, I would come out as a gay person, and I did.
For those of us in public morals, after the Stonewall incident, things were completely changed from what they had previously been. They suddenly were not submissive anymore. They now suddenly had gained a new type of courage, and it seemed as if they didn't care anymore about whether their identities were made known. We were now dealing with human beings.
Today I live in a senior citizen apartment building. What's different now is that I can be free. I have a daughter who's a senior citizen and my son is 58. They know about my homosexuality. My three grandchildren in their 30s know about their grandmother. I have a great-granddaughter who at the age of 10 learned that Grandma Jerry was a lesbian, and she thought that was most interesting. And yet I still don't have the personal courage to not care if these yentas in the building know that Jerry's a lesbian.
Well, I retired from the police department in 1976.
20 years have passed. I'm going to be 70 in a few months. I still don't know the answer. I would still like to know the answer. I would like to know whether I was wrong or whether I was right in ever thinking that there was a difference, in ever thinking that maybe you shouldn't trust a homosexual because something is missing in his personality.
The archives of lesbian culture, which surrounds us now and was created 4 years after Stonewall, owes, at least for my part, its creation to that night and the courage that found its voice in the streets. That night, in some very deep way, we finally found our place in history. Not as a dirty joke, not as a doctor's case study, not as a freak, but as a people.
Today I'm a 38-year-old drag queen. I can keep my long hair, I can pluck my eyebrows, and I can work wherever the hell I want. And I'm not going to change for anybody. If I change, then I feel that I'm losing what 1969 brought into my life. And that was to be totally free.
How can I ever close the door and be the same as I was before? Darling, no, no, I can't anymore. It's too vain.
I'm David Isay.
Remembering Stonewall, again produced by David Isay and Michael Shirker, with production help from John Fricke. It was engineered by Spider Blue and remixed by Carol Wheeler. If you'd like to learn more about David's work, you can go to his website at www.soundportraits.org. That's www.soundportraits.org. And if you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And we'd love to hear your response or experiences in this Gay and Lesbian History Month on this 30th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising. You can call our comment line, and we'll be playing comments over the next few weeks, at 212-209-2999. That's 212-209-2999. 2999. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Crimes against humanity, torture, mass graves. No, I'm not talking about Kosovo. I'm talking about East Timor. But in East Timor, the U.S. supporting the regime that's committing these crimes. Returning to Indonesia for the first time since the country's 1975 invasion of East Timor, the pro-independence leader and Nobel Peace Laureate, José Ramos Horta, has promised a power-sharing deal if the East Timorese win their independence after a vote, at this point expected sometime in August. Within minutes of his arrival in Indonesia, which for years, under the rule of the dictator Suharto, sought to have him arrested as a traitor, Ramos Horta had an emotional meeting with East Timor's most important independence leader, Xanana Gusmao. Gusmao remains under house arrest in Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia. The two met yesterday with other pro-independence leaders, including members of the National Council for the Timorese Resistance, ahead of talks this week on the future of East Timor. For 25 years, Ramos Horta and Gusmao have waged the same fight as two of Indonesia's fiercest critics. Ramos Horta in the corridors of the United Nations and the world's capitals, and Gusmao in the mountains of East Timor, and later in an Indonesian prison. The Indonesian regime gave Ramaswarta a visa to travel to Indonesia after much pressure to attend the talks, but refused permission for him to go to East Timor this month. The government has hinted they would allow him to travel to Dili before the August ballot as long as he does not campaign. Ramaswarta said he'll agree to the condition as long as Gusmao is also allowed to go to East Timor. Well, last week, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan announced that a vote on the future status of East Timor, scheduled for August 8th, will be postponed because of lack of security on the island. In the last months, hundreds of Timorese have been killed by the Indonesian-backed paramilitary death squads who are terrorizing the population there. After the announcement of the postponement of the vote, and just days before he went to Indonesia, I got a chance to speak to the Nobel Peace Prize laureate, José Ramaswarta, at the United Nations.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, José Ramaswarta.
Thank you.
Can you start off by responding to this postponement of the vote by, it looks like, at least 2 weeks?
Well, it is a decision of the Secretary General based on the assessment by UNAMET, by the Secretary General, of the conditions on the ground. I cannot but only say that we fully support the Secretary General's staff, both in New York and on the ground in East Timor, have been outstanding in the exercising of their responsibilities under the New York Agreement. The UN personnel on the ground in East Timor have performed with impartiality, with integrity. They have gained our trust. So when the Secretary General takes such an initiative, we accept with full confidence, good faith, and we regret that there has to be a postponement because we would like to resolve this problem. The sooner the better for East Timorese. But obviously, there cannot be a vote, voter registration and vote if there are no minimum conditions of security.
The Indonesian government has responded angrily, saying that the situation certainly can be in place by the August 8th vote. Can you describe what the situation is on the ground in East Timor?
The situation remains of pressure, of terror, of violence in the countryside. The militias are still armed. There is still ongoing training of militias in the countryside. There's ample evidence of that. And this is not only the assessment of the resistance, it's not only the findings of the UN, the Australian government, the United States administration, the European Union, the Japanese. It is the finding of the large contingents of international press on the ground. Left, liberal, and conservative media, everyone has been unanimous in pointing the finger to the Indonesian army for orchestrating instability there. So, there cannot be a voter registration and a vote on the future of the territory as long as conditions are as they are. So the postponement were inevitable, as we saw in the last few weeks. It was to be expected that the Secretary General, if he wants the UN to be involved in a process that preserves UN-bound credibility, they obviously couldn't go ahead with such a vote.
Can you explain how the issue of terror in East Timor affects the actual vote? In part 17 of the report of the Secretary General, it says, while the security situation has severely limited the opportunity for public expression by pro-independence activists, pro-autonomy campaigning has been actively pursued in many cases by local officials, and there are strong indications that public funds have been used to this end. What is happening in terms of the vote and the connection to the terror?
Well, the Indonesian side is conscious that if there were a free vote in East Timor, the pro-independence movement would win by overwhelming majority. So if you have certain factions in the Indonesian army that does not agree with the presidential policies of relinquishing East Timor, and why President Habibie initiated this policy, because he himself, he knows that it is no longer in Indonesia's interest to continue on with East Timor. Why he started this dramatic shift of policy a few months ago, it was not out of the blue, because he knows that on the ground the people don't want Indonesia. And there are some people in Indonesia, hardliners, who don't agree with that. They want to cling on with power to the control of East Timor. So what they do, they try to terrorize the population. It's not exactly a public relations campaign to win the hearts and minds. Now it's pure terror to intimidate the voters. Obviously, the UN cannot go along with that. And the UN is not alone in criticizing the conditions in the territory. It's the U.S. Congress, it's the U.S. administration, it's the Australian government, which was the closest of Indonesia for many years. It's the European Union, all the media. So I think Indonesia is pretty much isolated there.
We're talking to José Ramos Horta, the Nobel Peace Prize winner of East Timor. This just after the U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan announced last week that the vote in East Timor on the future status of the island that's been occupied by Indonesia for the last 23 years will be postponed by at least 2 weeks because of the continued violence there, violence that is caused by the Indonesian-backed Timorese paramilitary death squads. We'll continue with José Ramos Horta when we come back here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Certain thing that I learned from Jim, that he'd always make sure I understand, and that is that there's a certain way we all must swim if we expect to live off of the fat of the land.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to talk about what will happen in East Timor as the violence continues there, Indonesian-backed paramilitary death squads continuing to go after the civilian population, this part of the 23-year occupation of East Timor. Indonesian military has killed more than 200,000 people, a third of the population there. I had a chance to speak with the Nobel Peace Prize winner of 1996, José Ramos Horta, when he was at the United Nations last week, just a few days before he left for Indonesia, where this week he and other Timorese are engaging in high-level talks about what will happen in the island. This weekend, he met for the first time after about a quarter of a century with Xanana Gusmao, the rebel leader of East Timor, who remains jailed in Indonesia. And I talked to José Ramos Horta about his and Gusmao's being able to go back to East Timor.
What about the issue of you, also Xanana Gusmao, the rebel leader of East Timor, still imprisoned in Indonesia, not being able to go back and campaign?
Well, my return to East Timor, obviously, is my right. It's a very simple, basic right. If you tell a New Yorker, who lives abroad, well, you cannot go back to New York, who is going to understand it? So this is the issue, whether I or other Timorese, Xanana Gusmao, are able to go back to their country. Whether to campaign or not is a different issue. The issue is whether we are entitled to go back to our own home country after so many years in exile. There is a change of government in Indonesia. It was because of that previous government that we are not able to be there. There is a new government. There is democratic reforms in Indonesia. So the issue boils down to that, to one of the very basic issues in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And as long as Xanana is not released and is not allowed back to East Timor, there will be always a huge question mark over the legitimacy, the transparency of the whole process.
Are pro-independence advocates able to campaign right now? And would it make a big difference if Xanana returned before the vote?
Well, we don't even, the issue is not of campaigning as such. We don't need to do any campaigning. It's not like, we have, after 23 years of Indonesian occupation, we have to persuade the people about the pros and cons of being part of Indonesia and being part of being an independent nation. the issue is not there, even that. The position of the resistance is much more clear-cut, very simple, and that is there should be no pressure, no terror, no violence against anyone. You know, we are prepared to take part in national dialogue, in forums, in seminars, to explain to the people what is at the stake, the modalities of the vote, the procedures, and so on, without actually campaigning to show, you know, the advantage of independence or the disadvantage of joining Indonesia under this autonomy plan. So the issue is not really freedom of campaign, although it is an issue, obviously. You know, if you have a vote, it has to be right of people to free campaign. What I'm saying is we are so confident, you know, about our position that we are saying we for us it's not an issue of political campaigning, because the people of Istanbul do not need anyone to tell them how to vote. All we require is that there is no violence, no pressure, no corruption, no bribes, and so on.
On that issue of what's happening on the ground, how do you know that the Indonesian military is arming the paramilitaries in East Timor? What situations can you describe, and how many people have died as a result?
It's difficult to say how many people have died. Figures go from 100 to over 1,000 in between April and May. There is continued violence in East Timor, continued killings in parts of the country. Evidence of Indonesian training and arming militias is abundant, not only from reports we receive, but the United Nations representatives on the ground have caught red-handed the Indonesian army in training militias. And some of the UN personnel have confiscated weapons already, right in front of the cameras in recent days in East Timor. There's abundant evidence in media coverage of the training of the militias.
Looking at a comparison between what's happened in East Timor and the Indonesian military being allowed to stay as the referendum takes place, and, for example, what's happening in Kosovo, NATO forces and the United States immediately demanded the Serb forces had to pull out of Kosovo for anything to take place there. Yet in East Timor, you have a situation where the Indonesian military is not only allowed to stay, but is in charge of security. What is your response to that?
Well, I would say that maybe you should ask President Clinton, should ask NATO countries, Australia, why they were demanding Serbia withdrawal from Kosovo, although everyone knows Kosovo is part of Serbia, while the world knows East Timor is not part of Indonesia, and yet they are not demanding Indonesia withdrawal from East Timor. East Timor was never recognized by the UN as part of Indonesia. Kosovo was always part, historically part of Serbia. Yet they demand total Serbian withdrawal from Kosovo, which is extraordinary, unprecedented in international law, that you demand the conventional army of a country to vacate one of its territories. It's just unheard of. And yet in the case of East Timor, which a territory which is illegally occupied by another country, by Indonesia, as part of the agreement, you give a mandate to the army of occupation to guarantee security. Well, it's the same thing like asking Milosevic to guarantee security for the Kosovars, or Saddam Hussein to guarantee security for the Kurdish in northern Iraq.
And yet Portugal, who was negotiating this agreement at the United Nations with the Indonesians, supposedly on behalf of the Timorese, signed on to this agreement.
Well, again, I say, you know, you have to ask the Portuguese and the UN and everybody else these seeming contradictions. Of course, obviously, I understand and support the New York Agreement. The Secretary General, I think, did the right thing in pushing for this agreement in spite of all of these apparent flaws. And we see already the advantages of this agreement by having the UN on the ground.
Two questions. One is your response to the Senate amendment that passed earlier this week, calling on the President of the United States, the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of State, to pressure Indonesia to stop the arming of the anti-independence militias.
I am very pleased with this decision, as I have been pleased with the position that actions taken by the U.S. administration, particularly by Assistant Secretary of State Stanley Roth, in his numerous visits to Indonesia, meetings with Xanana Gusmão, the numerous representations made by the administration to the Indonesian side. The Senate amendment comes a long way in putting pressure on administration and Indonesia to do more. So I'm very pleased with it. It serves as a strong warning to Indonesia that it must change. Otherwise, there will be severe consequences in its relations with the United States.
There's a similar measure to the Senate amendment, the East Timor Paramilitary Accountability Resolution, which has been introduced in the House, which calls for a ban on U.S. military assistance and arms transfers to Indonesia unless Jakarta stops supporting the paramilitaries and ceases its own attacks on civilians in East Timor. If this passes, what effect do you think this would have?
It will have a dramatic impact because the Indonesian army is almost entirely dependent in its relationship with the United States. Including for issues such as prestige, credibility. Indonesian army cannot ignore the fact that the United States is a superpower. It's a traditional ally for since Indonesia's independence. Indonesia must remember that one country that supported Indonesia's independence in the 40s was the United States. So it is in the United States is not like a, is not a country that was not in favor of Indonesia's own independence. So in that regard, the United States is in a very strong position to demand that as much as Indonesia, you know, fought for its independence with U.S. support, it must now honor the New York Agreement and allow people of East Timor to be independent if that's what they wish. So I think the position of the United States is quite a determining factor, and it will not be unnoticed in Indonesia.
Also in recent days, the East Timor Action Network, last question. Also in recent days, the East Timor Action Network got documents that were leaked about World Bank funding of paramilitaries in East Timor. Can you talk about how this happened and what you're doing about it?
Madame, I don't know how it happened. You have to ask the ITAN people. I know the document.
I don't mean how they got it, but yeah. Can you... I should have said it differently. Also, in recent days, it's come out that World Bank funding has been used to support paramilitaries in East Timor. Can you explain how this works and what the World Bank is doing about this?
I don't know what the World Bank is doing about it. There is evidence, mounting evidence, there are authenticated documents showing that the millions of dollars from the social safety net, which is vital, you know, for the well-being of millions of poor in Indonesia, are being diverted, wasted to fund a war, to fund killings in East Timor. I think the World Bank will have to take some very drastic measures because otherwise the World Bank will be dragged into this very messy, grotesque story. It is a scandal of enormous proportion. So I believe the only logic and simple thing the World Bank has to do is to freeze now releasing funds to Indonesia until a full investigation uncovers the extent of the misuse of taxpayers' money to fund a war. It is not only like corruption for some of the rulers to put away in Swiss banks or to buy villas. It is even worse than that. Funds that have been diverted in order to fund a criminal war against innocent women and children. Evidence is there. So I think the World Bank will take, I trust that the World Bank will take some very drastic actions.
José Ramos Horta, the Nobel Peace Prize winner of East Timor, speaking to Democracy Now! At the United Nations last week, just days before he went into Indonesia for the first time in almost a quarter of a century and met with the rebel leader of East Timor, Xanana Gusmao, as well as other Timorese, as this week they meet to decide about how to strategize about the future of East Timor. Xanana Gusmao continues to be imprisoned in Jakarta. He remains under house arrest. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and as we wrap up this show, we wanted to bring this story closer to home and follow up on this issue of the World Bank and the expose, the revelation of documents that have been found in East Timor indicating that World Bank funds are going to support the paramilitary death squads. Joining us on the phone is John Miller. He's with the East Timor Action Network, which got their hands on the documents. Welcome to Democracy Now!, John.
Hi, Amy.
Can you explain further what happened here, and then we can talk about a vote that's coming up in Congress this week?
The documents were delivered by us to the World Bank about a week ago, and our Washington representative met with them and just came up against a wall of denial that, you know, this isn't World Bank money being used, and they've told the Indonesians that if it is, they can't use it this way. And what we're saying is that if the World Bank wants to be sure that its money isn't misused, it should do two things. One is continue a hold it put on additional money to Indonesia, particularly these social safety net funds, for the Indonesian national election that happened at the beginning of May. And that hold lasts till the end of June. And that they did that hold specifically so that the funds wouldn't be used during that campaign. And we say that no more money should go to Indonesia until it's clear that there's been a free and fair vote in Indonesia. We've also said that if the World Bank wants to be sure that its money isn't being misused, money it's already sent, it should go into East Timor and audit how it's been used. It's not only as serious as it is that the money may have been used to fund the paramilitary militias, and Indonesia's in the process of legitimizing some of their leaders by appointing them to head civil defense units, which are part of the Indonesian military structure, an official part, but that they're also being requested so that they can be used to campaign, and that it's a violation of the agreement that Indonesia signed at the UN for local or any Indonesian government officials to be involved in campaigning on the referendum on autonomy or independence. And so if the World Bank wants to be sure its funds aren't being misused, send the auditors in, look at the books, and make sure that's not happening.
John, on the issue of a vote this week in Congress...
Congress last week, as you, Jose, mentioned, the Senate voted to urge the Clinton administration to intensify its efforts to stop, to have the Indonesian military stop arming and actually move to disarm the paramilitary militias, to stop blocking humanitarian aid to the thousands of refugees that these militias have created, and to start withdrawing its troops from from East Timor, which are the only ways to ensure a free and fair vote in East Timor. The House has a similar resolution that we hope will be coming up soon, which, you know, in addition to calling for all of those things, also calls for suspending any remaining arms sales, spare parts, training, anything that supports the Indonesian military. Because what's going on in East Timor, all these violations of the UN agreement are clearly the responsibility of the Indonesian military, that the president of Indonesia, the civilian government of Indonesia, you know, seems to be committed to seeing this process through with, we'd say, varying degrees of enthusiasm. But it's the Indonesian military that's actively working to undermine the efforts of the UN, of the international community, of the East Timorese themselves, of whatever political persuasion, to resolve this issue and to finally find out what was denied them when Indonesia invaded, whether the East Timorese want to be independent, whether they want to be part of Indonesia. And the only way to do that is to have a free and fair election.
John, if people want to find out more information, where can they go on the web? Where can they call quickly?
The East Timor website is www.etan.org. That's www.etan.org. And they can call 914-428-7299 if they'd like to get information, find out what we're doing.
Thank you very much, John Miller of the East Timor Action Network, 914-428-7299. That does it for today's show. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, the number to call is 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland is our technical director. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!